Deer versus Q Club Hotel. Mr. Ramey.
May it please the court. Travis Ramey for Q Club Hotel, who is the appellant and cross-appellee in this case. Your Honors, this is a breach of contract action arising from a condominium declaration. And the briefing raises several issues, but they really break down into two buckets. The first is whether the declaration allows Q Club to retroactively charge for shared costs from previous years. And the second is whether the trial court abused its discretion when it denied Deere's Rule 59 motion. Because it's the issue that we raised in our side of the appeal, I think it makes sense to start with the discussion of the back charging issue, of course, yielding to the court's question. At the threshold, the declaration is not explicit. We start with the language of the declaration, as we always do, but the declaration is not explicit about back charging. There is no thou shalt or thou shalt not language in the document, which means we get to tunnel through it to figure out what it means.
There is a provision, there are provisions in the declaration that deal with reasonable reserves. Which is, I think, relatively typical in these types of agreements. So was there a reserve available in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. The unit owners have reserves. I believe it is Deere's position that those reserves are intended to be used exclusively for repairs, replacement of items within the individual residential units. The position we have taken is that we are allowed to go after those reserves for, among other things, undercharges for shared costs. But Deere's position is that any back charge at all is invalid under the declaration. So it doesn't matter what the source of funds are. You simply can never go back. Once the clock strikes midnight and the ball drops on New Year's Eve, you're stuck forever. The Q Club is stuck forever.
The reasonable reserves would not be available to satisfy any back charging issue.
Correct. Under Deere's interpretation, that's correct, at least as I understand his argument. So at the threshold here, we start with the proposition that the declaration obligates the unit owners to pay 40.4967%, which with the court's leave, I'm just going to call 40.5% of the shared cost. That's an obligation under Section 7.3 and Section 12.3 of the declaration. To effectuate that obligation, the declaration authorizes Q Club to make a number of different type of charges. Among them is the annual regular charge, which Section 12.3B also refers to as an original charge. But it also contemplates an amended charge, a revised charge, and then Section 12.3.
It looks pretty clear that it has to be during the year.
For the annual amendment to the annual regular charge, Judge Pryor, I absolutely agree. But the construction of that sentence, the during the year language, is in a parenthetical with the word amended. The word revised falls outside of that parenthetical. And the only way you attach those two, I think, is to conclude that the word amended and the word revised are the same thing, which, of course, would be contrary to the general rule of construction that if a drafter uses different language, we presume a different meaning.
See, I just think if you read the context of that passage, the say, the four sentences that include the sentence that you want to ride, everything is talking about intra-year charges and changes. The annual regular changes of such year, beginning January 1 and ending December 31, annual, semi, or quarter annual for the calendar year, during the year, shorter than a full calendar year. It's really just that one snippet of language that you've pulled out that says at any time.
Well, Your Honor, the sentence
you outside the calendar year.
Judge Newsom, the sentence before that, you're correct. The sentence before that says the charge amount and applicable installments may be changed at any time by the hotel unit owner. And if that means nothing different than the calendar year language in the next sentence, then that reading takes that sentence, the first sentence, the charge amount can be changed at any time. It makes that sentence completely meaningless.
Or no, does the context just inform the meaning of at any time? At any time in the context of this passage means at any time during the calendar year.
Well, Your Honor, again, I think no, because I think it takes that sentence. You could, under that reading, you could take this sentence, the chart that begins, the charge amount and ends adopted by the hotel unit owner. I think you could strike that whole sentence from section 12.3B, and it would not alter the meaning of the language at all. So to conflate that sentence with the sentence after it, the at any time with the parenthetical regarding at any appropriate time during the year, is to read that previous sentence out of the agreement.
Why? Tell me something. Why would we read? I understand that a material variation in terms can mean a material variation in meaning, but why would we not read the words changed, amended, and revised as synonyms here?
Well, again, Your Honor, they are synonyms, and it is possible to construct those.
If they are, then the district court was right.
Well, I think even if the court were to conclude that the revised charge and the amended charge are functionally the same thing, the court still has to deal with the language regarding all other charges in Section 12.3A, which I don't think there's any good textual basis to moor that to this at any appropriate time during the year. Under Section 12.3A, Q Club is entitled to make, and the unit owners are obligated to pay, quote, all other charges hereinafter referred to or lawfully imposed.
This is good that we've sort of transitioned. What are the other charges hereinafter referred to? What are those? If not the things that we've already kind of talked about?
Well, I think they probably are those, but the other charge also talks about charges or lawfully imposed.
So just so we're clear, at least principally, you're kind of riding the other charges lawfully imposed language.
Correct.
And what does that mean? That any charge that's not otherwise illegal, is you're kind of good to go, charge it retroactively?
I think that's correct, especially when coupled with the language in Section 12.4 talking about the cumulative nature of remedies, that Q Club doesn't give up any of its remedies by not charging. It retains all remedies, such as a remedy to set off or a remedy to make charges based on an unjust enrichment or a breach of the contract.
If we were to agree with you that you can impose back charges, where does it end? Where's the limit?
Well, Your Honor, one, I think the limiting principles here are there's no theory under which Q Club gets to recover more than 40.5% of the shared costs.
No, but how many years back?
Well, I think that's subject to basic rules of law, doctrines like latches, statute of limitations, waiver, estoppel. In fact, I think it's the Thompson case talking about retroactive condominium assessments in our brief discusses that very issue in the context of back-charging condominium assessments. So this isn't a chargeback forever in a day. There are limiting principles in the law that limit this, and had Deere could have sought, as relief in this case, cast out some percentage of the back charges because they're too stale. But, of course, that claim has not been raised, and now likely in this case the ship has sailed. Also, I think it's important to look at in Mr. Deere's appeal, the question about assignment of the shared cost question to the jury. The district court concluded in its order denying Rule 59 relief that had been invited error, specifically based on the pretrial stipulation where Mr. Deere referred to this as a jury question. Mr. Deere's counsel's statement in the pretrial conference that was a question for the court to decide and not the jury, and the lack of any motion for judgment as a matter of law. Now, while we agree in principle that construction of an unambiguous legal document is a question of law, whenever Mr. Deere raised that issue at trial, it was always in a different context. It was not in the context of asking the court to decide the issue and take it away from the jury. At pages, document 151, I think that's the fourth day of trial, pages 199 to 201, Mr. Deere's position in his reply brief seems to be that he joined Q Club's motion for judgment as a matter of law, but the record simply doesn't support that. There's no use of the words you would expect, words like join or motion or judgment as a matter of law. He couples it with statements about instructions that he's going to ask to be given to the jury, which belies that there was a belief that this was a request to resolve the issue. And given that Deere had previously stated, you need to send this to the jury, that's asking a lot of the trial court to read behind all of that and know that Deere's counsel had changed its mind and now wanted this question to be decided by the court. There are also inconsistencies later about requesting an instruction, and there was no joinder of Q Club's renewed motion at the end of the trial. I see my time has expired on the other issues. Unless the court has specific questions, I'll stand on the briefing.
Thank you, Mr. Ramey. Mr. Sweda.
May it please the court, Robert Sweetapple, Douglas Broker, and Matthew Weising on behalf of the cross appellant. First of all, I'll only speak briefly about the back charging because the real reason that the back charging is so offensive, as if the violation of the declaration isn't enough, is because none of those back charged monies were even owed under the declaration. What we're asking the court to do here is to interpret the declaration as it's written, not to buy into a contrived reading by the Q Club or to ignore the specific terms of what a shared component is, but to answer the court's questions with regard to how this occurred. Keep in mind, there's $11 million in alleged back charges for a six-year period. Those back charges were more than the actual charges that were imposed. These weren't costs that somehow were overlooked. This is the result of a program imposed to attempt to generate profits and revenue where none are owed. And so what's interesting is that at all times, and counsel's correct, we both, at the pretrial stipulation, said this was an issue of fact. There were still doubts as to what exactly happened. There was complex as to what was billed. But that stipulation, that pretrial stipulation that this was a jury issue, was completely abandoned. And there's no doubt about it when you read the transcript. At the Rule 50 motion.
Did you make a Rule 50 motion?
I actually, Your Honor, joined in. I said, I concur with the motion.
How do you join in a motion that asks for judgment for him?
Because the grounds of the motion were that the court should decide as a matter of law whether or not the declaration allows what we were seeking. And I said to the court, Your Honor, we stipulate. We had a stipulation that superseded the pretrial stipulation. I said, Your Honor, I stipulate, contrary to the pretrial stipulation, I now stipulate with Mr. Letao that this is a clear issue of law. We now know through Mr. Muckamal's adverse testimony that the entire methodology was changed to bill for the operation of the hotel less than arbitrary 20% number. And we stipulate this is a matter of law for the court to construe and to give to the jury. And I concur with him that you are to look at this declaration and you are to decide liability. And throughout the trial, and under Rule 50 as it was revised in 2006, as the court knows, You can make the motion at any time in any form. I repeatedly...
When did you... just so I'm clear, you can make the motion at any time in any form.
I made the motion when I concurred with Mr. Letao's motion and asked the court...
The difficulty I'm having with that is that his motion said, "Dear District Court, enter judgment for Q Club." You can't join that motion. You don't want judgment for Q Club. You want judgment for Deer.
But what I did join in on was that he should decide it. And I said, if you decide it and you actually look at the language, you're going to determine that all of these charges that are not for shared components, that we win. Go ahead and then later on, before Mr. Malkamal was recalled, I again made the argument to the court.
Did you just so I'm clear, it hasn't been all that long since I was the lawyer sort of panicking about preserving my Rule 50 arguments. Did you in any way, shape, form, or fashion file a paper or utter the words, "I want judgment as a matter of law under Rule 50?
No, you don't have to do that under the rule anymore. If you Morris has an extensive...
So when you say...
Did that answer his question?
No, I didn't. Yeah, to answer your question, I did not say... I came in at the time of the Rule 50 motion, and I repeatedly said that you should enter judgment as a matter of law on liability.
Okay, so you said you should enter judgment as a matter of law for me
on
the shared costs.
Yes, yes. If you look at the transcripts, and I can read to you what I said to the court if you'd like me to do that. Would you care to have me?
Quotations, citations, whatever you can point me to, where I can find in the record that you actually made what could plausibly be called a Rule 50 motion for judgment as a matter of law for Deer. Not just, this is a legal question in the abstract, but it's a legal question, and I win, and I want judgment.
Yeah, that "I win" part is really important, because the thing I'm going to want to get to after you answer that question is, it's one thing to say that it was error to submit a legal issue to the jury, but I don't see how you've explained how there was any prejudice from it. But
Don't waste all of your time giving me quotations. Just
what
some
I'll do
citations,
is I'll
citations
have
to the record,
the
and then get Judge Pryor's question.
I can tell the court that I said to the judge, I made the argument we win because I said they're charging for in-room cleaning. They're charging for in-room for rental of the room. They're charging for linens. They're charging for housekeeping, and for marketing these rooms, millions of dollars, and I put in testimony from Mr. Malkamal that was occurring, and I said to the judge...
You've argued on appeal in your brief that it was error to submit a legal issue to the jury, but you haven't explained why it makes a difference.
Why it makes a difference? I'd like an opportunity to do that.
Well, you know, you had your opportunity in your brief. Can you show me anywhere in your brief where you made that argument?
That it was...
it made a difference.
Yes, because...
Where in your brief did you say that?
I think, Your Honor, we argued Florida law, which
you argued Florida law about how this is a legal issue, not for the jury. I don't understand where in the brief you make an argument about why it made a difference.
Well, I think that it's well established under Florida law, and we cited the case. Which was a 1927 Florida case, Your Honor, where the court said that it's reversible error when, here's what the court said in the Leesburg case, the court cannot shift the burden of construing a contract to the judgment of the jury.
Yeah,
the court must construe.
I get all that, but you also have to explain why your interpretation is correct.
Okay, I'll be happy.
Your brief doesn't do that.
Why our interpretation of the contract, of the declaration?
Yeah, I mean, so what would the difference have been? See, you
oh, I think we do that.
It's wrong to give this issue to the jury, and I'm wondering, well, how did it make a difference? And I get nothing from your brief about it.
I think we argued that extensively, Your Honor. If I understand your question, and if I don't, please interrupt me, because I want to make sure I understand your question. The jury never understood, because the judge did not construe...
It wouldn't matter if the jury understood or not. Your point is it wasn't for the jury to decide.
I understand that.
So if it's done correctly, how does it work?
Here's how it would have worked.
In the brief where I get an explanation.
Here's how it worked. Here's what happened, okay? The court construes the entire declaration and rules as a matter of law on unambiguous language. What the court should have done is it only ruled on one aspect of the case. It ruled as a matter of law the declaration prohibits back charging. Yes.
We get that.
Then.
And you say, we went on that. We won on that below. That should be affirmed.
I urged the court, as did Mr. Lateau.
After you had stipulated pre-trial that this everything was for the jury, then you decide later, maybe there's some jury issues here. You've said that on appeal.
No, because all the issues of what was charged are discussed in the declaration. So to answer your question, what the judge should have done is he should have looked at the declaration. And if you look at the declaration, you see that the residential units are not part of the shared components. And in fact, the appellant stipulated to that on page 5 of their brief, and they said exactly what we were trying to get Judge Kahn to recognize. And this is what they said on page 5 of their brief. The quote, the shared components are essentially the entire building, excepting the residential and commercial units themselves. So when you understand the scheme of the declaration, it's clear that the shared components are not the entire hotel unit. The shared components are not the common areas. The shared components are an easement that the residential unit owners have to cross through the hotel to use the pool, the lobby, the exercise room, and it's all of the interior HVAC, phone lines, and that. So there's an easement that the residential units have to pay for. So the way you can tell that is when you actually look at, and here's the heart of the case, when you look at the scheme that's agreed to in this agreement, you see that under Section 12, what is the hotel's job? It says under 12.1, the hotel unit owner has granted easements with respect to certain portions of the hotel unit and agreed to repair, replace, improve, and maintain, manage the hotel unit. Okay, so they're responsible for maintaining, managing the hotel unit. What is the consideration the residential unit owners are giving? In consideration of the foregoing, each residential unit owner and each commercial unit owner, by acceptance of a deed or other conveyance of the applicable unit, and whether or not expressly stated, shall be deemed to agree that the costs incurred by the hotel unit owner in or reasonably allocated to the repair, replacement, improvement, maintenance, management, operation, ad valorem tax, obligations, and insurance of the shared components. So all the residential unit owners have covenanted to do in exchange for the hotel running the hotel, managing the hotel, they're only agreeing to pay for the shared components. They paid for only the shared components for 7 years. And in 2013, the Q Club decided, instead of charging for the shared components, let's charge the entire operation of this hotel. Let's double what they owe. Let's take the position that the residential units, which are privately owned, the declaration makes it clear, the hotel unit has no right to even enter those private properties. They have no easement. Unlike the residential unit owners who have an easement, the hotel unit owner has no easement, and the hotel unit owner has the right to enter into a UMA agreement, which came into evidence, and they get 55% of the revenue for managing the room, marketing the room, and what do? They now say, let's ignore the fact we can only charge for shared components, and instead of maintaining the lobby and the pool, let's bill them $1 million fee to Hilton because based on the revenue that we got from renting as a bonus. And the brief is replete with explanation as to why that is in violation of the agreement. In addition, valet parking under Section 3.4. Mr. Litow, on behalf of the Q Club, argued to the judge, as did we, that the valet parking provision should be construed as a matter of law. That provision allows them to charge valet parking charge the owners, the residential unit owners, for valet parking, and keep the revenue. What do? They charge for valet parking, they keep the revenue, and then they bill approximately $1 million in what they said they had to pay the valet company, even though it was a profitable operation. Another example of their gouging by disregarding the declaration as written. It was Judge Kahn's job to interpret the entire declaration as a matter of law and instruct the jury. The law is clear that that is reversible de novo. There's a Florida case we cited, American Medical International, which makes it clear that even if the jury is the one that ends up making the legal error because they misconstrue it, it should be reversed. And now it's this court's job, I respectfully submit, to examine the declaration and to ask yourselves the same question I asked Judge Kahn. I said, Judge Kahn, the declaration we've now stipulated is unambiguous. Before, we thought it was ambiguous. We didn't know what the evidence was going to come out. Now Mr. Muckamal has admitted for us that they're charging for the residential unit.
What happens if we find that you did not move for judgment as a matter of law? Do you lose?
Pardon?
If we find that you did not.
That's moot. That doesn't matter because if you read the American Medical International case, this is an error of law. Right. This
is that you have to have preserved, correct? I think that's Judge Branch's question.
Well, I think when you see the citations where I make all these arguments to the judge repeatedly, I do it at the Muckamal.
But her question, just to be clear,
her question is, assuming we find that you did not move for judgment as a matter of law, what happens to your appeal?
I think that it's still, you still should reverse because when you look at Rule 59E, which we filed a motion, it's manifest error. It's manifest error of law. If there's manifest error of law, it should be corrected by the court. The manifest error of law here
you
is...
You invited the error because you started off with the pretrial stipulation that you concede where you said this all goes to the jury, and then if we don't find that you did not move for judgment as a matter of law, how have you not invited this error?
Well...
Assuming it's error.
You're saying that that manifest error is excused because a lawyer stipulates pretrial.
No, I'm asking you.
Both lawyers stipulated, and both lawyers upon, this is a very complex document, complex facts, hundreds of thousands of dollars of accounting done to figure out what was happening. We didn't know when we filed this case what exactly were the costs that caused this to skyrocket. It was during Mr. Muckamal's examination that I actually understood the specifics of the fact these were all related to the room. So I would answer your question this way. I would say to the court that there's no doubt that I repeatedly, and you don't have to use the word Rule 50, you don't have to say judgment as a matter of law. If you read the rule and you read Moore's, you will see that you need to make the court aware. I repeatedly made the court aware. It's your job to construe it. If you construe it, you will see. Now, there's old cases pre-2006 that say you have to come in at the close of the, very formalistic, prior to 2006. Now the point is to make the court aware. I repeatedly made him aware it's an issue of law. We win under it. These are not shared costs. The room should not be chargeable. We want this to go to the jury on just damages. I repeatedly did that.
Clock Scotchy, you're 2 minutes over, but you were answering questions. We have your case, Mr. Sweetapple. Mr. Brady.
Thank you for that opportunity, Your Honor.
Judge Branch, to begin by answering the question you asked toward the end there, if the court concludes that there was no motion for judgment as a matter of law from Mr. Deere, then Mr. Deere loses that issue. Under Ford X Rail Ford versus Garcia, if an error is invited, then the court does not even invoke plain error doctrine to reverse the case.
He says he didn't invoke the rule by number, but made clear that the district court should rule on this as a matter of law and why under that view, his client should win. Is that true?
No, Your Honor. I disagree with that altogether. If the court would look at document 151, pages 199 through 201, which is the spot where in the brief Mr. Deere's counsel said they joined the motion. I'm going to pick up on the language there. First of all, we concur. I'm quoting now. So surprise from when you first came in the courtroom, there's no doubt that the two issues in this case are issues of law. That sounds like we're about to move for judgment as a matter of law, but counsel goes on. And we're expecting and urging the court to instruct the jury that there is no ambiguity. The term shared component is listed under definitions and fully and completely defined, and we're going to ask the court at the conclusion of the case to instruct the jury on that. That doesn't sound anything like a motion for judgment as a matter of law or joining. It sounds like preview of coming attractions of what we intend to ask for in jury instructions. And it goes on, 201. The first full paragraph on 201 is a long discussion about jury instructions. When the conversations you references as to Muckamal's testimony are all requests to strike Mr. Muckamal's testimony. In fact, I think it's on page 243 of document 151. The court outright asks, are you making a motion? I think it's, are you making a motion to strike or a motion in limine? Is that all you're making? Or, quote, are you just making a motion in limine regarding what Muckamal said? And Deere's counsel responded, I'm moving to strike him and also moving in limine. I'm just advising the court why, so we don't have to have the jury out. I'm just going to say, Your Honor, I'm making my motion in limine. It's asking a great deal of a district judge to infer from a counsel who's standing up and talking about, I want you to instruct the jury this way, an instruction that ultimately it appears that Deere's counsel didn't actually ask for, or saying, I'm making a motion in limine, and to read behind that, that I'm not asking for what I'm actually saying I'm asking for. What I want is judgment in my favor on this issue. That seems a lot to me.
I just pulled out the rule book. I think I've almost never done this, but I just pulled out the rule book, and as I read 50A2, motion for judgment as a matter of law may be made at any time before the case is submitted to the jury. The motion must specify the judgment sought and the law and facts that entitle the movement to the judgment. It just doesn't sound like that happened.
I agree, Judge Newsom. I can't get there from here. There's been some discussion of the idea that the court should review this determination de novo. I think because it's invited error, the court shouldn't review it at all. But if it's been assigned to the jury, presumptively it's an issue of fact. And the court generally doesn't sit in de novo review of the jury's factual findings. The shared costs issue is simply not a new deal. It's enforcement of what the shared costs always should have been. Judge Pryor, you asked, where is it in your brief that you argue that if the judge had ruled on this, we win? I don't see that either. In fact, I think we argued in our yellow brief that under Sapupo and Singh and other authority, this issue had been waived. And I do want to try to bring together the back charging question just briefly and why I think our reading of the declaration is the better reading. I get that the court may not be persuaded about the difference between amended and revised, but the reading we give to the declaration, unlike Mr. Deere's reading, does at least make an effort to give all the various terms meaning. It looks at the different types of charges instead of concluding that the only charge that exists at all possible ever for shared costs is this annual regular charge. It attempts to give effect to two different time limitations without reading these one of them completely out of the declaration. It reconciles itself with this non-waiver language in Section 12.4 that not sending bills does not waive any obligations. An obligation would also include the obligation to pay the correct percentage of shared costs. On top of that, it respects Section 7.3's discussion of paying costs of the hotel unit, the clear intent of the drafters for the shared costs to be borne at 40.5%. by the unit owners, and it does not turn the revision or amendment of the charge.
Mr. Ramey, clock's got you.
Judge Pryor, thank you.
Thank you. We're in recess till tomorrow morning. Thank you.